Now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. We're 8 minutes after 6 o'clock. The president continues his meetings in the Middle East this morning. He is meeting with the leaders of the GCC+3. It's his whirlwind tour of the Middle East. And he is meeting today with several regional leaders, including the UAE president. Meetings coming on the sidelines of the summit of the countries that make up the Gulf Cooperation Council, in addition to Iraq, Jordan, and Egypt. It is known as the GCC+3. Biden there to reassert America's role in the region, according to a senior administration official. Now, that comes on the heels of his visit to Saudi Arabia, and a lot of criticism. It was the fist bump heard round the world. As the Washington Post sums up the meetings, quote, the president's 3 hours at the royal palace in Saudi Arabia were seen as a diplomatic win for the crown prince, who has tried to rehabilitate his image. Biden seemed to approach it as a necessary, if somewhat distasteful, step to improve relations with the world's top oil exporter at a time of rising gas prices. The meeting drew outrage from critics who believe that Biden was abandoning his pledge on human rights, particularly when it came to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the U.S.-based journalist who wrote for the Washington Post. Rolling Stone headline, Biden fist bumps ruler who ordered execution of U.S. journalist. Another headline, Biden's shameful fist bump with Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman shocks Twitter. Washington Post CEO says the fist bump between President Biden and Mohammed bin Salman was worse than a handshake. The president explained the meeting at a press conference yesterday afternoon.
Mr. President, what was the Crown Prince's response to your comments about Khashoggi?
He basically said that he was not personally responsible for it. I indicated I thought he was. He said he was not personally responsible for it, and he took action against those who were responsible. And then I went on to talk more about how that dealing with any opposition to the or criticism of the Saudi administration in other countries was viewed as, to me, a violation of human rights.
Sir, two quick questions, if I may. First, we just heard from Jamal Khashoggi's wife, who said, after this visit, the blood of MBS's next victim is on your hands. What do you say to Mrs. Khashoggi?
I'm sorry she feels that way. I was straightforward back then. I was straightforward today. This is a meeting. I didn't come here to meet with the Crown Prince. I came here to meet with the GCC and nine nations to deal with the security and the needs of the free world, and particularly the United States.
And it was somewhat of a raucous day when it came to the media earlier in the day, as President Biden was meeting with the Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Peter Alexander of NBC News asked this question to a room full of leaders.
Thank you.
Jamal Khashoggi, will you apologize to his family, sir?
Thank you, guys. Thank you, guys.
President Biden, is Saudi Arabia still in China? President Biden.
Thank you.
The Crown Prince was silent, as was the president, and you see the presser at that point ended. And it has been a whirlwind tour for the president, and he has been plagued by the events here at home. So even when he is away, the questions continue as to gas prices and what may be moving forward. And as we go to cut E, this is President Biden on the gas prices when asked that question at the press conference yesterday in Saudi Arabia.
On gas prices, if I may, you said that we'll see relief at some point in the not-too-distant future. What is the message to Americans who are looking for that relief now? When should they expect to see a real change in prices, though they've already been coming down? They've already been coming down.
That's right. They've been coming down every single day, to the best of my knowledge.
When will we see the impact of this visit?
I suspect you won't see that for another couple weeks. And we'll see more when we see gas stations start to lower their price consistent with what they're paying for the oil.
And that is President Biden, of course, addressing the issue of gas prices. We are at 6:13. This is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. We'll be talking a lot more about the president's visit with John Gizzi coming up in the 7 o'clock hour. Jennifer Harper will join us. She's got some interesting poll numbers, as always, for us. Jim Trusty will be along, our legal expert, and a fascinating legal case out of South Carolina involving an attorney who has now been indicted for murder, the Alex Murdaugh case. You may have heard about it. It's been in the news for quite a while, but that indictment just came down yesterday. So we'll be talking with Jim about that. We'll be checking in with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, the latest developments on Ukraine, and also the development of a U.S. hypersonic missile. And K.T. McFarland will join us coming up in the 7 o'clock hour as well with the big picture view of all of this. But first off, we head to the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Howard County, watch out for accident activity on 95 southbound near Route 32, where the two left lanes are blocked. So traffic is now getting by to the right, but traffic is jammed through the area. In Cheverly, the earlier accident eastbound on 50 at the VW Parkway clear, but delays remain. And also in Lorton, an accident now reported on Route 1, both north and southbound. All lanes are blocked at Lorton Road. Also in Loudoun County, Business 15 southbound is closed between the Leesburg Bypass and the Battlefield Parkway due to crash activity. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly sunny to at times, mostly cloudy on this Saturday. Scattered showers and thunderstorms developing midday and into the afternoon. They will continue through the evening. Highs today in the mid-80s. Later on tonight, storms end. Lows back in the 60s to low 70s. More of the same on your Sunday. Partly sunny, scattered showers, afternoon storms, I think, will be likely. High temperatures tomorrow in the upper 80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
75 degrees at 6:18 on the Saturday Morning Update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
Well, we're trying to make sense of the news. It's not easy these days. And inflation, of course, has been a big issue in the talk of more spending in Build Back Better. The president was hoping to get Democratic approval, but Joe Manchin says, nuh-uh, we don't need any more spending right now. And here's how he put it.
Everyone should be very cautious of what we're doing and how we're approaching things now and looking at anything that could inflame the inflationary high numbers that we have.
And he continued.
Until we see the July inflation figures, until we see the July Federal Reserve rates, interest rates, then let's wait until that comes out so we know that we're going down the path that won't be inflammatory to add more to inflation. Inflation is absolutely killing many, many people.
Well, the Democrats were furious, and a number of things were said by Democrats on Capitol Hill about Joe Manchin yesterday, none of them particularly friendly. And, of course, it came up in Saudi Arabia at the president's news conference, and he was asked about Joe Manchin.
On the issue of climate, Joe Manchin obviously made significant news right now, which appears to be torpedoing what was one of your biggest priorities as it relates to energy and to climate back at home. Your message to those Americans right now who are looking for that relief that would have a wide impact as it affects the climate and energy specifically?
I am not going away. I've used every power I have as president to continue to fulfill my pledge to move toward dealing with global warming. Thank you,
Mr. President. Thanks, is Joe Manchin negotiating in good faith?
I didn't negotiate with Joe Manchin. I have no idea.
Thanks, guys.
Oh, did you catch the laugh from the reporter? Whew, pretty tough stuff. As we look at all of this, inflation, the question marks, where it's coming from, the Democrats blaming everybody but the administration themselves. And here's Mitch McConnell with his take on inflation.
One of the first and most painful consequences of the Biden administration's failed policies has been the soaring cost of energy. Remember, on their party's watch, the cost of heating a home rose by double-digit percentages last winter.
So that's Mitch McConnell on it. Now, Alyssa Slotkin is a Democrat from Michigan, and she spoke the truth. You don't hear too often from Democrats when it comes to the spin and how they're trying to position all of the inflation problems that they're having and border problems and all of the other misinformation that they put out there and excuses and basic lies. Well, Alyssa Slotkin, she realizes that the spin isn't going over. So here's a Democrat from Michigan talking about the spin.
I think people can feel and see spin, and I don't think they like it. You're sitting around the kitchen table at night, your kids have gone to bed, and you're trying to figure out how much money is coming in and how much is going out. Those math equations are not looking great right now for the majority, at least in my state. So I want to be just straight about that, and then I want to say, here's the plan, here's the path. I want to be transparent because people know that this is a problem. We shouldn't try to pretend it's not.
And I always like to look at the words of John Kennedy, the senator, and he always has a way of kind of putting it in perspective for us, and he certainly cuts through the spin here.
The American people they're very disappointed in President Biden and his policies. A majority of Americans believe that he has mismanaged Congress, he's mismanaged COVID, he's mismanaged the border, he's mismanaged immigration, he's mismanaged crime, he's mismanaged America's energy independence. He's mismanaged Afghanistan, he's mismanaged the economy, and he's mismanaged inflation. Inflation is waterboarding the American people. People are scared they're not going to be able to retire until they're 92. The creepy banjo kid in Deliverance is more popular than the president at the moment. And he better reverse direction soon. It's hurting America and it's hurting him.
Well, Jake Tapper asked a question of Cecilia Rouse. She is an American economist and the 30th chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. She has been in that role since March of 2021. And here's what she had to say when asked about it all by Jake Tapper at CNN.
You know, I just feel like every month one of you nice people from the White House comes on the show to talk about inflation, and you talk about these tools in the president's toolkit, and you don't use them. You don't use these tools. And, you know, there's debating and discussing going on, and meanwhile, prices are still going up.
He wants to lower the deficit, which we know also addresses inflation. He wants to do so, you know, by increasing taxes on the wealthiest individuals and corporations. He needs Congress to do so. He wants to ensure that we're making chips here at home. Part of the price increases is the lack of supply of cars. And that goes back to our semiconductor chip. And Congress needs we're open and willing. It's a great time for Congress to act on these important economic initiatives.
He's the Democratic president, and the Congress is controlled by Democrats. So it's not as though you guys don't have each other's phone numbers.
Brilliant. And it's kind of funny, you know, they just continue to blame everybody but themselves on gas prices, inflation. Biden is blaming the service station owners for the high prices. I don't think so. We've just had that clip from Cecilia Rouse. Here's another one of Cecilia when she's placing the blame.
So let's go back to the roots of this inflation. This inflation has its roots in the pandemic, which snarled supply chains. Yes, just like other countries around the world, our federal government, our monetary system supported the economy so we could get through the pandemic. And now we have Russia's war against Ukraine. So when you add these together, we have the unacceptably high levels of inflation.
Of course. Now, Janet Yellen was in Bali this week, and she was asked about it, and of course, she got the talking points.
Our greatest challenge today comes from Russia's illegal and unprovoked war against Ukraine. We're seeing negative spillover effects from that war in every corner of the world, particularly with respect to higher energy prices and rising food insecurity.
And at another time during the week, the Secretary of the Treasury had these reassuring words for us.
We're taking our own steps that we believe will be supportive in the short term to get inflation down.
Okay, we're taking those steps in the short term to get inflation down. How long have we heard that? Transitory, wasn't it? It is 6:23. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. And I'm finding that the people that work for the Vice President, Kamala Harris's office, are really pretty smart people. And, you know, you might be surprised to hear me say that, but I think they're all pretty bright because they're all leaving. Her chief speechwriter is leaving after only 4 months on the job. Also, her domestic policy advisor and longest-serving aide is leaving. Now, the speechwriter is Megan Grube. She just came onto the job in April. Oof. I guess when she writes the speeches, but the vice president ends up making a word salad out of them, probably kind of frustrating. Before the White House, she worked as a speechwriter for Bill Gates and an editorial director at Gates Ventures. Can you imagine leaving the founder of Microsoft to come to work for the White House and the vice president, and you leave after 4 months? Ouch. And the same day that her departure was leaked, the Washington Post reported the vice president is set to lose one of her closest and longest-serving aides, Rohini Kosoglu. Previously served as chief of staff in Harris' Senate office and on her short-lived presidential campaign. Staffers in the vice president's office have been jumping ship after a full year of messaging blunders and a barrage of personal attacks on a VP, combined with low poll numbers and viral rumors of toxicity within the office and tensions between Harris and President Biden's offices. Those are not my words. Those are the words of the Daily Mail. So a little chaos there at 1600 at the Naval Observatory. 6:25 now on the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
In the news at 6:30, President Biden meeting with leaders of Arab Gulf countries in Saudi Arabia today, closing out the final leg of his four-day trip to the Mideast. The effort to bolster U.S. positioning and knit the region together against Iran. The White House says that Russian officials have visited an airfield in central Iran at least twice in recent weeks to view weapons. They're weapons-capable drones that it's looking to acquire for use in its ongoing war in Ukraine. The administration releasing that intelligence from Saudi Arabia. And the House committee investigating the U.S. Capitol attack has subpoenaed the Secret Service for text messages reportedly deleted around January 6th of 2021. The panel probe, of course, into Donald Trump's actions at the time of the siege on the Capitol. The committee chairman, Benny Thompson, said that an aggressive timeline is needed for production of the documents, wants them by Tuesday. He says the panel seeks the relevant text messages as well as any after-action reports that have been issued in any and all divisions of the Secret Service. 6:32, the Saturday morning update continues. Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Howard County on 95 southbound at Route 32, that's exit 38. Left lane still blocked with crash activity. Watch out for delays there. In Virginia, there is an incident on Route 1, which is closed north and southbound at Lorton Road. That due to an accident. And in Fairfax, crash activity right now is on eastbound 236 in the vicinity of Ollie Lane. Several lanes blocked with this incident, so watch out for delays. Also, in Loudoun County, Route 15, Business Route 15 southbound is still closed between the Leesburg Bypass and Battlefield Parkway. Follow police direction around the accident scene. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly sunny to at times, mostly cloudy on this Saturday. Scattered showers and thunderstorms developing midday and into the afternoon. They will continue through the evening. Highs today in the mid-80s. Later on tonight, storms end. Lows back in the 60s to low 70s. More of the same on your Sunday. Partly sunny, scattered showers, afternoon storms, I think, will be likely. High temperatures tomorrow in the upper 80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
75 degrees, 6:33, the Saturday morning update. It is the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you for being with us this weekend. Jennifer Harper is with us every week. She writes Inside the Beltway at your Washington Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
All right. So we have a trillion-dollar question. Help us out on this bad boy.
Yes, we do. we already know the implications of trillions of dollars with the White House, but there's a lot of folks who are wondering if the U.S. economy is going to revert back to the economic challenges of 45 years ago. Let's do the math on that. This is what Neil Cavuto had to ask. Do you guys ever start feeling like it's Jimmy Carter deja vu, and that's where we're heading? He was actually talking about the U.S. economy. He asked that to Jared Bernstein, who is a member of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. He also served as an economic advisor to President Biden when he was vice president. So I started thinking, well, what the heck was the economy like during the Carter years that we're so afraid of? So there was a historical summary of the economic situation that was compiled by the University of Houston, and here it is. When Jimmy Carter took office in January 1977, unemployment had reached 7.4%. Carter responded with an ambitious spending program and called for the Federal Reserve to expand the money supply. Within 2 years, inflation had climbed to 13.3%. And with inflation getting out of hand, the Federal Reserve Board announced in 1979 that it would fight inflation by restraining the growth of the money supply. Unemployment increased and interest rates rose to their highest levels in the nation's history. By November 1982, unemployment hit 10.8%, the highest since 1940, and one out of every five American workers went sometime without a job. So let's talk about the current realities, and certainly the Republican National Committee is paying attention to that. This is what they have to say. After a red-hot new 40-year high in the Consumer Price Index, producer prices skyrocketed at near-record highs, increasing to an eye-popping 11.3%, plummeting confidence in the economy, the most unpopular president in modern history, soaring inflation, and a looming recession. If you haven't gotten Jimmy Carter deja vu, you will. And that's from Tommy Pigott. He is Rapid Response Director for the Republican National Committee, and that's what he said in a statement sent to me.
Yeah, I think one thing some of the media people are realizing and talking about is that the folks in the administration don't necessarily have business experience. You got a lot of think tank people, and they come out of places like Harvard, but they're not particularly street smart when it comes to handling all this stuff. And you've got some poll numbers from one of the traditionally liberal institutions, Harvard.
Yes, Harvard. And Harvard is still very liberal. And if you want to look at whether there's political diversity at Harvard University, well, apparently not. And this is according to an annual survey of the faculty itself. And it was conducted by The Crimson, which is the school's student newspaper. And here's what they have to say. More than 80% of Harvard faculty respondents characterize their political leanings as liberal or very liberal. I repeat, 80%. A little over 37% of faculty respondents identified as very liberal, a nearly 8 percentage point jump from last year. Only 1% stated they were conservative. Again, this is coming from a poll conducted by the students, and no respondents whatsoever identified as, quote, very conservative, and a very slim little percentage, a brave 16%, said that they were politically moderate. And according to the analysis, again, this is coming from Harvard students themselves, when asked whether they would support increasing ideological diversity among faculty by hiring more conservative-leaning professors, only a quarter of the respondents were in support, and in contrast, 31% opposed hiring conservative professors to increase ideological diversity, while 44% of the respondents said that they neither supported or opposed it. And also, a majority of the faculty members are very uneasy with the idea that those who ever worked for former President Donald Trump's administration would join their ranks. They don't want anyone to hire somebody from the Trump administration. The survey found that 56% of the faculty would support extra vetting for any officials from Mr. Trump's team, while 30% would bar former Trump administration officials from the teaching staff altogether. And this was a survey of 476 members of the Harvard faculty, and it was released on Thursday.
So much for a free country. I hope that 1% conservative doesn't get outed because he'll get fired this week. Every once in a while, you'll see something bipartisan on Capitol Hill. There was some gun control legislation that has been labeled bipartisan. You've got another area?
Yes. I don't ever like to be the bearer of bad news all the time, but there is actually something that Republicans and Democrats will agree on. And believe it or not, it's in climate issues. And this is according to our friends over at the Pew Research Center. They are indefatigable pollsters. Anyway, they say that an overwhelming majority of U.S. adults, that's 90%, support planting a trillion trees to absorb carbon emissions, okay? 90% say it's let's plant a trillion trees to absorb carbon emissions. And so the pollster says there is a near consensus among both Democrats and Republicans in favor of planting large numbers of trees. That would be 91% of Democrats and 89% of Republicans think that's a good idea. But, oh, Rick, wait, there's more. The poll also found that 79% of the respondents were in favor of granting corporations tax credits for developing carbon capture and storage technologies. I don't know what that is, but sounds good, I guess. Anyway, 88% of Democrats and 70% of Republicans agree with that. This is a Pew Research Center survey and a big one of almost 11,000 people, and it was conducted in May and released on Thursday.
I hate to rain on the parade, but with the drought in the country, who's going to water a trillion trees? Where are they going to find the water? But I don't mean to be a cynic, but whatever. It's always something. Well, back to the bad news. Seems to get worse by the day on the southern border in terms of the number of smugglers who are leading illegal immigrants across the border. What are you finding?
Well, you know, it seems like the media is not paying a whole lot of attention to it down there right now, and perhaps there's a reason for that. But the very intrepid reporter, Fox News, Bill Milligan, he had a live report this week from Eagle Pass, Texas. And he was documenting the arrival of an absolutely enormous, that's what he called it, single group of illegal immigrants crossing the U.S. border. This was in Eagle Pass, Texas. They had drones overhead to show what he was seeing. And he said hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of people. That was his description. And again, drone cameras overhead were documenting all that. He says that the Del Rio sector down there is averaging almost 2,000 illegal crossings every single day. And as of Monday, the Border Patrol's holding capacity was 200% over what the normal capacity should be. Again, this is coming from Fox News. Mr. Milligan also described what he witnessed as a, quote, blatant smuggling operation in broad daylight. The temperatures were as high as 108 degrees. He said this border crisis is not seasonal. It does not slow down in the heat, and the migrants are not listening to Vice President Kamala Harris when she says, do not come here. Most of all, he says, when the administration says the border is closed, take a look at the videos and judge for yourself.
Yeah, Kamala's done a bang-up job down on the border, that's for sure. The administration's been walking kind of a fine line over Ukraine in terms of not wanting to get into a war with Russia. But some people may kind of beg to differ with whether we are or not.
Yeah, this is a sort of kind of a subtle and alarming finding. Again, we're going to have some numbers, so brace yourself, everybody, for this Saturday morning. This is an Economist YouGov poll. They say, here's just the numbers, 28% of U.S. adults think that the Russian invasion of Ukraine will lead to a war between the U.S. and Russia. 27% think a war between the two nations is not very likely. 19% are unsure. 10% think a war between the U.S. and Russia is very likely. 10% say a war between them is not likely at all, but 7% say that the U.S. is already at war with Russia. A lot of mixed feelings there, but it kind of shows you the people are paying attention. May not seem that way, but I think they're paying attention.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. You can follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin. Thank you very much. 6:44, Saturday morning update. We'll talk to Jim Trusty next, but first, Michelle Murray is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
Several accidents in Virginia to watch out for. On Route 1, both north and southbound at Lorton Road, all lanes remain blocked due to accident activity. Follow police direction there. In Fairfax, there is still the accident on eastbound 236 at Ollie Lane. Three lanes blocked there, so follow police direction there as well. And in Loudoun County, on U.S. 15 Business Route 15 southbound, that is closed from after the Leesburg bypass towards Route 7 near Edwards Ferry Road. So follow police direction around this accident scene. Also, you will still find crash activity in Elkridge on 95 southbound near Route 32, blocking the left lane. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WML Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly sunny to at times, mostly cloudy on this Saturday. Scattered showers and thunderstorms developing midday and into the afternoon. They will continue through the evening. Highs today in the mid-80s. Later on tonight, storms end. Lows back in the 60s to low 70s. More of the same on your Sunday. Partly sunny, scattered showers, afternoon storms, I think, will be likely. High temperatures tomorrow in the upper 80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
75 degrees in the nation's capital. 6:45, the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trusty joins us each week, and he is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. You see him a lot on the Fox News Channel. He is the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Story that kind of went away for a while and is back. And it's fascinating, and I'm not sure that people have been following it too closely. They probably have heard the name Alex Murdaugh. Well, he was indicted yesterday for murdering his wife and his youngest son. He is an attorney in South Carolina. We've talked about this before, but this is a new development, and this is something that will be a miniseries one day. So walk us through it, Jim.
Sure. Well, when we talked about it last time, I think I made the comment that if I saw this in a movie, I would laugh at how unrealistic it is. It's actually getting stranger and stranger and wilder and wilder. Murdaugh comes from a long family in the Lowcountry of South Carolina that have been legal giants. In fact, he was the head solicitor, the head prosecutor for that region for a long time. He was in a private firm more recently. And the story began basically when his wife and youngest son were found shot to death at a property where they kept dogs, actually, for the family. And Mr. Murdaugh apparently had a perfect alibi because he had been visiting his ailing father, who died soon after, and his mother at a nursing home, at least in theory, at the time of the shooting. And it began to unravel as more and more criminal acts started to swirl around Mr. Murdaugh. One thing that happened that I think was the day or the week that we talked about it was he was driving on a very circuitous route to Columbia, South Carolina, when he claimed his car broke down and a random stranger pulled up in a pickup truck and decided to shoot him. The story on its own seemed odd, and sure enough, the guy that shot him was arrested for it and turned out to be a former client. And the former client was part of a scam where Alex was going to basically commit suicide for the insurance proceeds. I don't know which end of them bailed out at the last minute, but it turned into an insurance fraud case, which led to an investigation into Alex stealing from his law firm to the tune of about $8 million, claims of a drug addiction, and then rumbling stories of other criminality on behalf of his surviving son, as well as his son who had been killed. So when we last left it, it was already a pretty insane story. But what's happened since then has gotten really interesting. There's basically two things. First of all, Mr. Murdaugh was disbarred from the state bar. Doesn't seem like that should have been a very heavy lift. But it was interesting because when they disbarred him, they're not even reaching a judgment about murder. They're saying this is a guy who's already admitted to stealing from his law firm, lying to authorities, and engaging in all sorts of kind of financial misconduct, including faking his own murder. So they were fine disbarring him. He's in prison on a $7 million bond. But the big development that happened this week was an indictment on Thursday for the murder of his wife and young son. And although in the abstract, it seems like, of course, he was involved. He's involved in every other crime. This was actually what looked to be a very tough case. It had been unsolved for some period of time. And what tipped it over the edge were two pieces of physical evidence that are really interesting. The first is a video showed up that is of the wife of Miss Murdoch and the son. And it's a very kind of random, goofy video. There doesn't appear to be anything exciting on it, except it has a timestamp. And the timestamp is shortly before their murders. And you hear a voice on this recording, and it's Alex. So the man who was supposedly alibied by being up with his father at the nursing home was, in fact, at the scene of the murder before it happened. So that's a big evolution. And there's really nothing worse for a criminal defendant than a disproven alibi. You know, people aren't usually in the business of faking alibis unless they've got something to hide. The second piece of evidence, Rick, that is, I think, maybe even more powerful, or at least equally powerful, is called blood spatter evidence. And in fact, it's specifically called high velocity impact spatter. Now, what does that mean? Well, you can imagine that in a crime scene, if a person comes to a crime scene, like Mr. Murdoch claimed he did after the fact, he could easily get blood on him, right? If he reaches down, tries to do first aid, you know, holds on to his loved ones as he realizes they are dead, there's certainly a possibility of having a blood transfer simply from that. But high-velocity impact spatter is different. This is the type of droplets and the pattern of droplets of blood that show you were there when the gun was fired, when the bullet impacted the person's body. So when you combine a false alibi and now this videotape and blood spatter evidence that shows he was right there when the shooting took place, either as a shooter or at least next to a shooter, it becomes a really powerful case. So he's been indicted finally, and we'll see where this goes and see what other crimes are solved in the process of looking into Alex Murdoch's sordid life as a former prosecutor.
Like I said, a miniseries. Wow. So the guy that he set up to shoot him, is he in jail?
He's in jail from the insurance fraud case, from the fake suicide case. And I remember thinking at the time he got arrested, boy, oh boy, if he was involved in the killing of the wife and son, this is about the time he's going to start singing. And that's one thing we really don't know. We don't know if he was involved in the shooting of Murdoch's wife and child. But if he did, there's a real good chance that once he got caught on the insurance scam that he decided to get on the right side of the government and talk about Alex's involvement. That would add to that forensic evidence pretty nicely. And by the way, Murdoch was also involved in this mysterious death of his housekeeper, who reportedly tripped on family dogs and fell down the stairs, only leading to a massive settlement with Murdoch's best friend lawyer and apparently Mr. Murdoch. So reopening that case as well as all the other mischief.
Let's turn to the Supreme Court, the justices, the protests at their homes, the continuing lack of enforcement of a federal statute that prohibits intimidation of Supreme Court justices at their homes. I assume the Attorney General's not going to do anything about this.
The Attorney General hasn't budged an inch, and that includes after an attempted assassination of Justice Kavanaugh. What's happened in recent weeks, Rick, is the person responsible for the security of Supreme Court justices and law enforcement, the marshal of the Supreme Court police, she wrote to the governors of Maryland and Virginia and basically threw up her hand saying, the Attorney General won't do anything. Will you please enforce state or county statutes to stop these protests from happening? And they've been happening religiously at the homes of Kavanaugh, and I believe it was Roberts this week as well. Well, there's a couple of things that have become kind of interesting developments. The first is Montgomery County at long last has said, you know what, I guess we will enforce one or two of our laws that might apply to this. That's actually trickier than you might think. What they're talking about is disturbing the peace. And disturbing the peace is it's a dinky little charge. It's a little misdemeanor that carries, you know, a maximum of 30 days of imprisonment. But it's actually a very difficult charge to prove, believe it or not. I used to, you know, prosecute them from time to time when I was a state prosecutor in Rockville. And the reason why is you have to show not just that somebody was mouthing off to a police officer, but that they were making enough noise to actually disturb the community and that it was unreasonable. It wasn't just some exercise of First Amendment rights. And so what you would see as a prosecutor all the time were these kind of half-baked cases where a police officer said, well, he was yelling and being a jerk, so I charged him with disorderly conduct or disturbing the peace. The problem is that's not enough to prove if you're really going to go to trial. Well, today's Montgomery County Police have learned from Jim Trustee's failures way back when, maybe, they are actually using noise measuring devices to see how loud things are going. They've got the advantage of camera footage from their body cams, which they intend to use, and they're giving individuals a warning, which I think is very smart on a couple of levels. They're basically saying, look, we are going to start enforcing this law. If you make enough noise to disturb the peace, then we're going to arrest you for it. So they're actually putting themselves in a posture where the violation of that law will look very willful to a judge or jury, that they were warned and they kept doing it, as opposed to just suddenly being handcuffed. And so they're going to start enforcing that. I think it's for really three reasons. One is the request that came in from the marshal. Secondly, they're seeing the evolution of this behavior in a bad direction, which is the Morton Steakhouse incident, where people were going to restaurants to disrupt not just the family of the Kavanaughs, but anyone that happened to be at the restaurant. And, you know, the evolution or the aggravation of the already obnoxious behavior starts to kind of call out law enforcement to do something about it. And finally, I think they've looked at it and they've given up on the Attorney General. And to circle back to your starting point here about the Attorney General, Rick, this statute 18 U.S.C. 1507, it is not some dusty, archaic, never-used statute. It's a law that's been used successfully since its inception in 1950. There were convictions in Washington, D.C. just 5 years ago for people disrupting the Supreme Court inside the courthouse, and they pled guilty to 1507 and were sentenced under 1507. So there's never been a sign of controversy in terms of the willingness to use this particular law until our current Attorney General walked away from it. And I'll give you another piece of evidence that shows that this is entirely political as opposed to a real legal justification. And that is this. If you're at the Department of Justice and you think there's an issue about the constitutionality of the law, you have a couple of options. One is you can go ahead and prosecute and let judges figure that out. If it's a close call, sometimes the judges or the appellate courts are going to decide whether or not it was constitutional. But the easier path, and one that's used frequently when they have a question about a statute, is the Office of Legal Counsel at DOJ. And the Office of Legal Counsel are the types that sit around and wait for these requests and analyze it and give constitutional assessments that DOJ then relies on. Well, there's never been a request for the Office of Legal Counsel to opine about 1507, nor any other obstruction statute in the ballpark. You know, there's a whole bunch of obstruction statutes with similar intent to impede justice that have never been challenged. And what I did find, which I think speaks volumes, is legal counsel had an opinion from 1981 about whether there could be a federal prosecution for potato farmers in Maine blocking the roads from Canada with potatoes because of their spat with Canadian potato farmers. Now, two things. One, OLC had enough time to opine on that. Tells you they're not too busy. But secondly, think about the contents of that. I mean, they're willing to give opinions about spud obstruction, but so far nobody's asked them about Supreme Court attempted assassination obstructions. And so, you know, I think that this speaks volumes to the fact that Merrick Garland has made a political decision, he's sticking by it, and it has no legal justification whatsoever.
So what's new for this administration? Jim Trustee, partner at IFRA Law. You can follow him on Twitter at Trustee Lawyer. Thank you very much.
Sure, thank you. Have a good weekend.
And you too. It is 6:58. John Gizzi coming up. We'll also be talking with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer and KT McFarland. Stick around with us.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.